I'm Daniel Vitalis of DanielVitalis.com, and you're listening to the Rewild Yourself podcast, a show dedicated to transcending human domestication, activating our invincible genetic health, and uncovering our true potential. In each episode, we explore the many aspects of the rewilding lifestyle for better health, fitness, and a more rich and fulfilling life. Rewild yourself. Engage your biology. Rewild Yourself is brought to you by SirThrival.com. SirThrival is a leading nutritional supplement and metafoods company that supplies essential formulas and ingredients for the rewilding lifestyle. Go to SirThrival.com to find a line of products that promote vigorous health, adaptation, and recovery, and help to unlock our epigenetic potential. SirThrival. Why just survive when you can thrive? Hey, welcome back to the show, and I'd like to, before we get started, invite you over to DanielVitalis.com to check out my coming events page. I'm spending 2015 mostly focused on writing and really tuning up this show. So I'm not doing a lot of in-person events, but I do have a five-day workshop. That's like my big workshop for the year. It's going to be hosted at the Omega Wellness Center in Rhinebeck, New York, and that's the 11th through the 16th of October, 2015. And I'll be presenting what I call my elementary school curriculum. Now, that is nothing to do with the elementary school most of us went to as kids, but rather is an exploration of earth, water, air, and fire, the four elements, and how we can use that ancient understanding to design modern lifestyles for ourselves that are tailored to our unique needs. So we can build health into our lifestyle, so we can build fitness into our lifestyle. So that's 5 days. If you don't have a background in attending workshops, I just want to say for me, that has been one of the methods, probably one of the most powerful methods I've used for accelerated learning. So when I find a teacher who really speaks to my heart, who really speaks to my mind, who has knowledge or wisdom or experience or skills in an area that I want to develop out, I find workshops with that person and I go study under them. And if you're interested in the work that I've been sharing and you'd like to work with me personally, this is your opportunity in 2015. So check that out. And that's 5 days. So that's a nice long workshop. That's an immersive experience. And if you're not familiar with the Omega Center, know that this is a really cool, cool place. So you can stay right there on the grounds. They have their own gardens. They make their own food from their garden, fresh food there. There's saunas, there is yoga classes, there is all kinds of stuff going on. So that's like a really immersive environment in which to do a workshop. And they have been hosting things like that there for years. So they really know what they're doing. It's going to be an awesome event. So again, go over to DanielVitalis.com, check out the coming events page, and get signed up for that event. I would love to see you there. Now, if you followed the last dispatch of Rewild Yourself magazine, that was Dispatch 8, Death and Rebirth. You know that the subject of death has been on my mind and definitely something I've been writing about and interviewing people on. That subject is a broad one. And there's this one piece in there that I feel like really needs to get addressed. And that is what we do in our funerary practices, and in particular, what we do with the remains of the people who die in our lives. Recently, just watched a family go through this where somebody passed, and I just watched that process as they try to figure out, you know, what do we do with this person's remains? Most of us don't really clearly lay out for our loved ones how we'd like our own bodies dealt with, and of course that's because we have such a strong death-denying culture, and we almost want to pretend like death is going to get cured, and therefore we don't have to worry about that. The reality is, all of us are going to die at some point, and we need to figure out what's going to happen with our own remains. And if we don't make a plan now, things might happen to us that we would otherwise not choose. I think that most of us are looking at either being pickled and preserved in toxic chemicals which pollute and destroy our environment, and then being sealed up in a kind of casket that keeps us from the elements and keeps us away from life forms who would recycle us, or having ourselves burned into oblivion. Both of those practices, as I see them, in my opinion, I don't mean to project this on anybody, but you know, for me, I've always seen this as a sort of a strange practice because both keep us from being returned to the life cycle. I think at some subconscious level, both are like almost ways of saying, You know, and I'm hesitant to say this because I know all of us have loved ones who have gone down either of those, whose remains have gone sort of one of those two paths. But for me personally, I want to be returned to the life cycle. And I think both of these practices are subtle ways that we communicate that we are different from the rest of nature, that we're not part of it, and our remains shouldn't be recycled. Organisms shouldn't eat us. We shouldn't become compost. That is finally changing. And there is a big movement towards what's called green burials. And I'm really excited by this idea. My guest today is Mark Harris, and he is the sort of subject matter expert on this topic. His book, Grave Matters, deals specifically with the green burial movement. And the interview with him today really elucidates not just what's happening in the modern American funerary practices and where it's headed, but also details how we can make sure that we put some things in place so that our loved ones know when we pass what we'd like done with our own remains. And if you're like me and you want to make sure you get composted back into the earth, then how you can go about making sure that that happens for you. I think you're really going to appreciate this show, and I think it's an incredibly important addition to the body of knowledge that those of us in the rewilding community are assembling. And I think this is something that we all need to really look at, really need to address. And I think you're really going to like what Mark has to say. Mark Harris is a former environmental columnist with the Los Angeles Times Syndicate and the author of the signature book on green burial, Grave Matters, A Journey Through the Modern Funeral Industry to a Natural Way of Burial. The book follows a dozen families who conduct natural burials for their dead, including burials in backyard gravesites and natural cemeteries, as well as sea burials and funerals at home, amongst other strategies. He lives with his family in eastern Pennsylvania, where he recently worked with the board of the Fountain Hill Cemetery in Bethlehem to create the Lehigh Valley's only natural burial ground, Green Meadow. Mark, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's nice to be here, Daniel. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, man. I really appreciate this cause that you've taken up. It's been something ever since I was young that's been on my mind, just going like, how long can we possibly keep doing this? Like, how much land are we going to dedicate to these graves and doing it the way we're doing it? But I always thought, Mark, that this was a religious thing. And in watching interviews with you recently, I realized this is a bit more of a strange and mixed history than I might have thought. How did we end up in a situation where we pickle people, put them in the ground and put a stone over the top of it?
Yeah, well, it's a fairly recent development. I mean, as you sort of suggested in your introduction, green burial has been around for a long time. What we call green burial was really nothing more than the default burial for humans, you know, from time immemorial. You wrap somebody in a shroud and you place them in the ground, and that's really been the way that many cultures over time have buried their dead. And really, it was not that different from the way we buried our dead in this country for the first 150 years or so. The Jews still practice what we call green burial, as do Muslims. So green burial is not anything new. The green burial movement is, in fact, just a return to something that's been pretty standard operating procedures for a long time. In this country, all that changed around the time of the Civil War. Up to that time, people died mostly at home. Women of the house, for the most part, would wash and dress the body, lay it out in an unheated front parlor or bedroom. Family members, friends came and visited, sat with the dead during vigils in the home. The body, unembalmed body, was then placed in a casket, taken on a cart to the back 40 or the backyard, and then lowered into a grave that had been dug, 6 feet under or so. And then that body, unembalmed, sometimes wrapped in nothing but a winding bedsheet, but usually in a plain wood coffin, was lowered into the ground. And the body was then allowed to return to the elements, and dust went back to dust. Then the Civil War happens, and in the course of the Civil War, most of the battles raged across battlefields of the rural South. Bodies were very hastily buried in graves that were very quickly dug, sometimes very shallow, near the battlefield. Family members in the North who wanted to retrieve their slain family members for a funeral and burial back at the home cemetery would send emissaries to locate the remains of their dead and bring them home. Those emissaries would then go and find those bodies, sometimes dig them up, sometimes get them from hospital morgues, place them in wood coffins, and then put those wood coffins on rail cars and send them north. Now, you know, that could be a pretty long trip, thousands of miles in some cases, and conditions in the rail cars, particularly in the summer months, were brutal. Bodies were actively decaying during the course of the trip. Putrefying gases were being built up within that coffin, sometimes sufficient to explode it, something that became known as exploding casket syndrome, which didn't make for a very pleasant arrival back at the home port. So it was at that point the battlefield surgeons began suggesting embalming as a way of preserving the dead for that long rail ride home. Of course, we've been embalming for a long time. The ancient Egyptians had done it thousands of years previous, and embalming had still been around. Battlefield surgeons had come up with an easier way to do it, and so they began advertising their services as undertakers began advertising their services as embalmers, and the process worked as advertised, and soon embalmers were setting up operations at the edge of battlefields and sometimes signing up clients before the battle even commenced. So really, you have embalming starting because of the need to transport those dead for the rail ride home back to their, you know, their northern cities. And then slowly embalming becomes a part of American funeral practices.
That's really interesting to me that it was more utilitarian than existential, because I almost would have thought that this was something slightly more existential. But could you describe for people a little bit about embalming? Because I feel like this is I think death in general is such a taboo, conversation to have. Most people aren't really thinking about it. And then it's very obviously a very small, select, kind of closed community that understands what this even looks like. But what does the modern embalming process look like for people?
Oh, wow. You know, I really spell it out in chapter one of the book, step by step, not in a gruesome way, but just very clinically what happens. And it's a very invasive process. And also, you know, as you suggest, it was a very clubby kind of group that was able to do this. So, and that was part of the reason you have embalming, or you have funeral practices move outside of the home, because really only, you know, up to that time before embalming, anybody could lay out their dead, they could have the wakes in their homes, and they could dig their own hole in the backyard. But really, only those early undertakers and battlefield surgeons knew how to embalm. They only knew how to do it, and only they had the patented, in some cases, embalming chemicals. So it became, you know, part of a trade. That this is not something a family could do itself. The process is basically a three-part process, and again, the gory details are all out in the first chapter of the book. But essentially, you know, the first part is about setting the features as you want the features to appear, in the casket. So you're looking to wash and cleanse the body, stuff the orifices, anus, vagina, ears, nose, mouth with cotton in order to make sure that there's no purging or there's no leaking of fluids. And then the body is, you want to get at some of the bacteria that speeds decomposition. So, you know, that's the second stage. So you're draining the blood from the body and then replacing that blood with a preservative, which is largely formaldehyde. So I think most of us kind of understand that that's what happens. But you have that embalming fluid, which retards decomposition, and since the embalming fluid is also filled with dyes, it restores a lifelike hue to the body. So embalming both retards decomposition and also makes a body appear lifelike, so that when you look in that, you know, you look at that body in a viewing, you see somebody who looks like that person's just slipped off to sleep. And that's, you know, really the whole purpose of embalming that we can talk about in some ways, is to give you what they call a pleasing memory picture, the funeral trade does. And that's to, they believe assuage any great grief that you may have at someone's passing. If someone is looking like they're just sleeping, then somehow that's easier to accept. Their passing is easier to accept than if you saw someone looking actually dead. I disagree with that, but that's the idea. But then, you know, you still have billions of bacteria that reside and thrive in your inner organs. And those are marauding through the body. And the second kind of embalming that we talked about there, the second stage, only gets at that, the decomposition that happens near the surface of the skin. So in order to get at those bacteria that reside in our abdomen and such, those inner organs, the embalmer then uses something called the trocar, which is, you know, Daniel, looks like a long arrow that has small holes to the fore of the shaft. The embalmer then takes that trocar, plunges it into the gut of the deceased.
Literally through the abdominal wall, just punctures right into there to where the intestines are?
That's right. Right around the north of the belly button.
Got it.
And, you know, the early embalmers, those Egyptians, would eviscerate the corpse. They'd slice it right down the middle and then reach in and remove all those organs, and then they would repack that liberated cavity with all kinds of material, straw, hay, spices, what have you. But the modern embalmer has the trocar, which does that. So he's plunging that into there, puncturing the abdominal wall, and then the those holes in the those openings in the front of the shaft are actually sucking out, puncturing the inner organs and sweeping around and vacuuming up all the liberated contents. The other end of the trocar is fitted with a tube which runs to a sink and an aspirator, which is sort of like a vacuum cleaner. It's just sucking it all up. And all of that liberated content is then sluiced down the drain. And then when all of that, so, you know, you can get the gory details again in the book. So, you know, you're puncturing the liver, you're puncturing the lungs, you're puncturing the heart, you know, the stomach. And so you've got all of that matter plus any undigested food, fecal matter further down and what have you. So all of that is sucked out of the abdomen. And then when it's clear, the embalmer then injects a very heavy-duty solution of formaldehyde in order to fill up that area and then retard the decomposition.
So they fill the whole abdominal cavity now, which has been essentially eviscerated out through this vacuuming. That's all just filled with fluid at that point?
That's right, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's filled with embalming fluid. Then the hole in the gut there is plugged up, and then the body is, you know, the features are rigid. The body is placed in the position with the hands, the mouth. Of course, then the mouth is sewn shut. The eyes are set in place with what they call eye caps, little contact lenses that go right on top of the eyes that have little barbs on the backside, so that when you press the eyelids on top of these contacts, they stay firm and keep the eyes shut. The body is tilted at various angles in order to make it appear as if, again, it's just sleeping. And then you have the cosmetizing afterwards, the dressing up the body, the shaving of the body.
Oh my gosh.
You know, sometimes even women are shaved because it's easier to apply makeup to a face that is hairless. Washing, dressing and what have you. It's a big show.
There's so many things that came out of what you just said for me. One, I kind of just want to point out, I think there's an interesting allegorical thing here with how the Egyptians built their structures and how they did their embalming. I mean, we're on some equally crazy immortality projects, but such a lower grade version of what they were doing. And so that's funny in the legacy of it, but
And when you think about what the Egyptians did, I mean, the reason for their embalming is that they really believe that you had to preserve this body for the purposes of the afterlife, and they were going to need all of these things, and they were going to need, you know, their organs and what have you. So you place them in these various jars. But really, modern embalming is more about, that one appearance that you're going to get of the body. Well, to preserve the body for everybody's eventual arrival at the funeral, and then eventually when you're looking at the body, it's that part's for show.
It's just a great snapshot into our psychology, I think, and just the shallowness of so much of what we're doing. I feel like, you know, so you mentioned that that industry, it sounded like an industry jargon term there for that last viewing, that memory image or whatever you call that in.
Memory picture,
right. I feel like just if the average person knew the gruesome kind of invasive procedure that went on, they would never be able to. I just don't see how anybody could really feel comfortable with that process happening to the corpse. But is there literally no other at this point? I understand what you were saying before about the Civil War. Obviously, we're not in that time now. Aside from those times where bodies need to be shipped, are there really any reasons left to do this outside of this purely cosmetic? You know, outside of supporting, I guess, the people who rely on this industry for a paycheck, is it just cosmetic at this point?
Well, you know, I mean, I rank on embalming, I guess, in the book, although I do try to present it fairly straightforward because, you know, as you're saying, it is extremely invasive and very gruesome, and most of us don't know exactly what happens in the embalming room, which is why I wrote that chapter. And, in fact, the whole book's mostly a natural burial, but it's those first two chapters on, you know, the environmental effects of burial and also what happens in the embalming room that people talk about most. And, you know, obviously funeral directors don't really want that information out there because, as you say, it's not anything you would want to happen to anybody that you loved. I will tell you this, though, that I have spoken to plenty of families over the years, and many of them are very disturbed by what they see. But it is also true that some people I've talked to have gotten great comfort at seeing their dead appear as if they were sleeping and at rest. So, you know, as with many things when it comes to death and dying, it's not always about what's logical or, you know, you make decisions based on all kinds of things, including, you know, sort of what you need emotionally, and that's harder to unpack. For me, I felt it was enough just to lay it out, so to speak. Here's what you get when you confine that body to the embalming room. Here's what's going to happen. And you've got to balance your need for that final look to be, you know, somebody who looks like they're asleep, with what happens, which is, you know, what's going to happen to them in the embalming room. I absolutely agree with the Jews who believe that, you know, that one of your responsibilities to the dead at the end is to let the dead rest in peace. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you can square that wish with what happens in the embalming room.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me. I mean, I think a 4-year-old girl gets a lot of comfort from being told she's a princess, but at some point she has to come to terms with reality. It's like, you know, we might get some comfort, I guess, from this, but I'm curious what your thoughts are about, like you mentioned, there are people who perceive this as being a comfort to them. However, in the past, they would have actually interacted with their dead. What do you think about the impact of death becoming so industrialized that we don't get to interact with it? I mean, really, we barely even get to see it anymore. It becomes this like almost this rumor more than a reality for us. I mean, what do you think the larger scale implications of that are? And do you think all this that we're talking about is symptomatic of that, or is it the cause of that?
Well, you know, I think it's complicated. I do think that we have blindly confined over care of our dead to an industry that's only been more happy to take care of it. So there was a time we had a closer interaction with the deceased, and my feeling is that we got a lot of healing through that more intense interaction, and that conversely, since we have less interaction with our dead, I mean, you know, the body is there, the funeral director comes and whisks it away, and you don't see it again until it's sitting in the coffin and you're viewing it. I mean, that's it. And I think that we miss out on some of the benefits that come from dealing more intensely with our dead. And it can be washing and dressing. It could be just sitting with the deceased in the deceased's own bedroom or their own home, or having a greater hand in the conduct of the funeral itself. And so, yes, I think that we may be short-circuiting the whole grief process by somehow looking at a body that, in fact, doesn't even look like it's dead. You know, there have been many people, including Kubler-Ross, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who, you know, came up with the stages of grief that she felt that, you know, we all move through and we need to move through in order to have a more healthy form of grieving. And she, for one, said that if you're looking at a body that looks like it's asleep, then you're, and on some level, not fully acknowledging that the death, in fact, has occurred, that you're looking at a dead body, not a sleeping body, and that we may not be moving through those stages of grief as neatly or as intensely as we need to in order to move on with our lives.
Yeah, it seems like a kind of an elaborate form of death denial to me to play this game where we dress the body up like it's still alive. I mean, it's like some kind of weird Weekend at Bernie's-esque.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, the other point is, you know, it's interesting. Many other cultures have a last viewing of their deceased, many other countries. And in fact, the United States and Canada are the only two countries on the planet that routinely embalm their dead. So it really does make you wonder, yes, we do it because of convention, but is there something about Americans that they seem unable to somehow look at a dead body as if it, you know, as it really looks, with the sunken cheeks and the pallor, you know, white pallor to the skin and what have you, and not somehow be able to grieve, accept the death? I mean, I just don't think that's the case. I think that we can, but we've, you know, we have bought into this system quite literally that is, I think, on some level, not as healthy for us as it could be.
Yeah, I like that you chose the word when you just described that short-circuiting sort of a natural process. And your book, and I guess your focus is, you know, here we are talking about sort of the negative side of this, but I really like the message you're bringing, which is this idea of green burial and something that's more natural for us. And this audience who's going to be listening to this interview, who I guess you're preaching to the converted here in the sense that these are people who I think are like, oh, this is an option. Cool. I'm on board. So assuming that we already agree with this idea of green burial, what are our options and how do we even where do we even begin? Because I know for me, soon as I heard you talk about this, it was like, yep, I need to kind of get this in motion now, even though I intend to have a long life. I want to make sure that I don't end up, creating more environmental, you know, havoc than is, you know, it's almost like one last offensive act to nature, right? It's like we live these lives of overutilizing resources, being a stress on the environment, and then in our death we have like one last, you know, middle finger to nature as on our way out. How do I not do that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, part of the reason I wrote those first two chapters was basically not just to lay out what happens, you know, in the embalming room and the environmental effects, but also to inform everybody that, you know, what usually happens in the American way of death, the embalming, the metal caskets, since most caskets that we buy are metal, and the concrete and burial vault at the bottom of the grave, you know, that's the modern American way of death. That, you know, in fact, we don't have to do a lot of that stuff. So, for instance, you know, embalming is almost never required. And in many cases, you don't even need to use a funeral director. That we can still wash and, you know, dress our dead and lay them out in our own homes, just like our forebears used to do. If we're interested in buying a casket, we can buy the casket ourselves. We don't have to get it from the funeral director. And if we use a funeral director anyway, he has to accept our third-party casket and can't charge us a handling fee to do so. So if you want to build your own plain pine box in your garage and then have it sitting there, you know, outfitted with shelves and use it as a bookcase and then finally use it, you know, for its final use, you can do that. I mean, you can build your own casket. You can go on the internet. You can do all this stuff. So I think even the step before, you know, sort of how do you plan it, just know that there are things that you can do legally. It's perfectly fine to do a lot of this stuff. The first thing I always advise people is, you know, decide what you want to do and then write it down and then inform your family members. So, you know, it's possible, quite possible, and it can be arranged to have a home funeral. So do you want a home funeral? Do you want somebody, a team of people, friends, family, to wash and dress your body, lay it out, you know, on your bed? And so do you want to have that? Do you want to buy a casket now? Do you want to be buried in a plain cloth shroud? Shrouds are being sold by a couple of people around the country now. They're beautiful. Do you want to build your coffin now? Do you want to, you know, buy a wicker casket? Do you want to build one out of seagrass? Where do you want to be? Do you want to be cremated? I do include cremation in my green strategies, which not everybody agrees with. Do you want to be buried? You know, and there are places you can be buried. Some places, you know, particularly in rural areas of the country, do allow for private family cemeteries in your backyard. So look at your zoning regulations. Do they allow for the establishment of these? Do you have a family cemetery that's in a more rural location? If you're going to be buried in your local cemetery, will they allow your burial there without the use of a burial vault? There's no state law that requires the use of a burial vault. It's the usual requirement of many cemeteries.
Now, that vault, tell us a little bit about the burial vault and what its purpose in these conventional burials is.
Well, you know, think back again to the way we used to be buried, hole in the ground, body in the casket, lowered, you know, at the bottom, and then you decay. There was no burial vault. But then, you know, in the mid-1800s, we see the appearance of a burial vault. Now, it's usually a concrete box. Some are a little bit more fancy, but it's basically a concrete box. The casket goes into the burial vault, and then there is a 1,000-pound concrete top put on top of that. So at first, the burial vault was designed to deter grave robbers from disinterring remains and supplying early medical schools with fresh cadavers. So it had actually a pretty good use initially. Right. And believe it or not, Daniel, that practice held until about the 1920s. People were still disinterring corpses and supplying, you know, medical schools until finally.
And this is because there was a taboo around the idea of cutting into bodies. I mean, what was the reason there for doing it that way? Was there just there weren't available bodies for the medical schools, or this was too taboo at the time?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think it may have just been having a lot to do with bodies not being a process to gain bodies for anatomical studies. So in setting up the system that we have now, where people donate their bodies in advance and what have you, you know, there was no system available for that. So people could actually make a little pocket change by turning into what they call resurrectionists, who would resurrect the body from their graves and supply the Egypt. So anyway, but then over time, what happened is, you know, cemeteries began demanding the burial vault because it served a very useful purpose, which is if you have a body in a casket, the body and that wood casket decay, and when they decay, the ground on top of it falls into the hole. So you've got a declivity in the landscape, and that makes for makes it difficult for mowing, and makes it slightly dangerous to walk around the cemetery, and then, you know, at last that hole has to be filled in. The burial vault prevents that from happening. So many cemeteries require burial vaults now. So, but if you don't want a burial vault and your cemetery requires it, you can ask that could it be at least a box without a lid that you turn upside down. So maybe you dig a hole, you place the wood casket on the ground, and then you take the burial vault, turn it upside down, and then place it over the casket. So at least the casket's sitting on the ground. And the purpose of the burial vault for the cemetery's, reasons still holds. That is, you know, keeping the ground above that. So you can look at that. And then there are all these natural cemeteries springing up around the country, Daniel. I helped start one here in my town. And I would say when I first was working on grave matters, you know, really began exploring the subject about 10 years ago, there were a handful of these natural cemeteries. Now there are about 150. And a natural cemetery.
Wow, in the United States there's 150?
In the United States, yeah.
Wow, great.
So a natural cemetery is a cemetery that, number one, forbids embalmed bodies from being buried, that if caskets are used, they have to be made out of biodegradable materials, wicker, pine, seagrass, what have you, cardboard, and there's no burial vault allowed. The whole idea is to allow the body to decay and become part of the elements and, push up a tree. So many of these around the United States take place in very natural-like environments. So the one I write about in Grave Matters is Ramsey Creek Preserve, the first natural cemetery in the United States, takes root in the western part of South Carolina on 30-some acres of a pine forest. So if you walk through the cemetery, you know, you look like you're just walking through the woods and bodies are buried, you know, on the side of the trail. In most natural cemeteries, upright headstones are not allowed. So you have a flat field stone collected from local stone. It lays flush to the ground. And, you know, in a place like Ramsey Creek, leaf litter is all over it. So it blends so seamlessly into the landscape that you really can't tell it's a body was ever buried there. So there are, again, there are about 150 of these natural cemeteries. The vast majority are like the one I started here, where a portion of an existing cemetery has been dedicated to green burial. So there was a fallow field at the edge of the Fountain Hill Cemetery here. We took a quarter acre and we turned it into a meadow of native wild grasses and native flowers to Pennsylvania. Bodies, you know, no burial vault to go into the ground. Mostly people have been choosing cardboard caskets. We have the flat field stones, that families can have engraved, and then they are buried in a meadow. So our scheme is a meadow. Many of the national cemeteries that I have seen that have taken root within existing cemeteries do take a meadow, a meadow model. So anyway, for anyone looking for green burial, you can begin scouting out the place where you would like to return.
How does this work with, okay, so I'm up in New England, and here, because we have such a long history of Europeans living here and their burial traditions, a lot of times a piece of property will have old gravestones on it, and as I understand it, it's illegal to disturb those. So do you know, if somebody has a burial vault, a casket, a headstone, is that piece of property then dedicated to that forever until something changes with the government, with the laws around this? Or, how does this work? And then how does it work in a green cemetery? For instance, will a second body end up in the same place an original body had ended up many years later? Is that possible? Or how is that tracked? And how does all that work logistically?
The Green Cemetery is like any other cemetery. It's, it's deeded as a cemetery. You can't just, bury, well, not legally, you can bury people wherever you want to. So, and the Green Cemetery is, the one we have, is plotted out like any other cemetery. So there are markers in the ground, things are measured. In many natural cemeteries, they do have this grid. Bodies are not buried on top of one another. But what is different, I would say, as far as the choice of your burial spot is, we practice what some natural cemeteries do, which is sequential burial. So it's not like you can say, I want plot 45 and be buried there. You are buried, or one is buried, let's put it that way, in the order in which that person comes. So
first come, first serve.
Yeah, exactly. Because otherwise you're destroying the meadow every time you go in there. We use backbow. So you kind of bury bodies one after the other as they come. Bodies are not buried on top of one another. So I guess this is a long way to answer your question. These graves are all marked off and plotted. At a place like Ramsey Creek, where I don't think that's really the case, all those burial plots are gridded out. They're given GPS coordinates. And so family members can go back in the future and, they can see where somebody was buried based on, a very extensive chart and also GPS coordinates. GPS may end up becoming pretty important because the natural field stones that are being used for grave markers will weather into the landscape within 100, 150 years or so. So, future visitors to your gravesite are not going to be able necessarily to locate it by the headstone alone. So you're going to need some indication besides the tree or the flowers or wherever they were growing there that a body is buried. So which raises some really interesting questions about the importance of having enduring grave markers and what have you. But Daniel, things are measured and plotted.
And what have you chosen for yourself, Mark? Obviously this is something you've been thinking about a lot. What kind of preparations have you made for yourself, if any?
I was sort of always waiting for a green cemetery to open up after I finished the book, and lo and behold, the local cemetery called me and asked if I would help them start this natural cemetery. So, it took us about 2 years. I worked with the cemetery board. We got this thing. It was a real hands-on project. And when we had our opening, we had our grand opening, and people came, and, you know, I gave a little introduction along with other people. And on the way out, you know, the manager of the cemetery said, "Well, Mark, we appreciate all your help. We haven't been able to pay you anything. This has been an all-volunteer operation, but we can give you this." So he then handed me two deeds to two plots, along with a note that said, "We appreciate your help. Here are deeds to two cemetery plots. It is our sincere wish that you do not have to use these anytime soon." So, Daniel, so far, I mean, that's where I plan to go. And sometimes on, you know, my daughters who are, you know, I've got a daughter in high school and a daughter in college, you know, they've been going up there for a couple of years now, helping planting and just walking around. It's really, really beautiful, you know, particularly in the summer when the wildflowers are in bloom and you've got, you know, bees on the bean balm and you've got meadow birds nesting in the meadow and, you know, the breeze is coming up the South Mountain. You know, I walk the grounds with them. Sometimes we're weeding and sometimes we're planting or mowing, and you know, I take great comfort in knowing that my daughters would return here in the future. To the extent they think about me, I think that's fine, but what I'm more jazzed about is that they will sit in this really beautiful natural environment and reconnect with the natural cycle of life and spend some quiet, private time in a beautiful green. And, you know, that's the benefit of a green burial, is that it helps return the living to an environment, gets them back into the natural cycle of life. And I think that as much as anything, that's the great benefit of green burial. It's, yeah, it's good for the planet. Yeah, it keeps some pollutants out of the ground. Yeah, you go very lightly at the end, but for the living, it gives them a place to return and reconnect.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a moment here, but I just want to inject the idea that I've thought a lot about the idea, because we have this idea that that cemeteries are these creepy places, right? They're like spooky and creepy. And the more I've thought about it, the more it's become clear to me, at least, that it's not creepy to me because there's dead bodies there. It's creepy because of the mentality that puts the dead bodies there and the way that they do it. That's what's so creepy to me. It's almost like an outward manifestation of this internal pathology that we have around our fear of death and our denial of death. But I do see the value in that place where a person can go. Can you say a little bit more about your personal thoughts on that, now that you've kind of mentioned with your own daughters and the idea of them having a place where they can visit? And obviously, you've already started to anchor in some of those experiences connecting you to that place. What are your thoughts on a person's, I guess, as we start to explore this idea of what's more natural to us and what's more natural for our environment, what do you think is a healthy approach in relationship to all of this? What do you think our needs are as a species to have some way of remembering the dead? Do you think the place is important?
I do think a place is important. And, you know, but that's me. And again, I think that our own feelings about what we need at the end are very personal. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to make any blanket statements about what people should do or not. And really, I've even had people come up to me and they say, "I've read your first chapter about embalming. I think it's terrible, but, you know, we're going to do it anyway." And I think, okay, well, but at least you're doing it from a point of knowledge. So there are people who bury at sea where, you know, you scatter cremated remains, or you can even do whole body burial at sea, which I write about in the book. And, you know, many people find that to be just fine. But, you know, there's no place that you can return to, really. You know, you can kind of sort of look out at the vast Pacific and know that your loved one is buried out there. But I know for myself, at least personally, I do find, I wouldn't call it comfort so much, Daniel, is, I don't know, it's just sort of some deep connection. When I go back to our, quote, family cemetery that my great-grandfather helped start in Rochester, New York, and I can go and I can walk and I can see the names of, you know, past Harrises who have been buried there, my great-grandfather and grandfather and, you know, my brother and, you know, many family members. And I do think there is a certain solace, I don't know what it is, that I feel. I feel a connection to my ancestry. Perhaps it's that. And, you know, it's nice. It's, I wouldn't say it's beautiful. It's quite pretty. But I think the advantage of a green cemetery is something more. I think that, you know, you don't have to. When we take families up for tours of Green Meadow, you know, you don't have to. You don't have to sell plots. That sounds gross, but you just. And maybe people who come up there are self-selecting, but I think that it speaks to family members on a visceral level. I think there's something about seeing a place that's full of life. And I think that's a big difference between a national cemetery and a regular cemetery. Other regular cemeteries can be nice. They can be really quite handsome. And in cities, they can be maybe the only green space around. You know, I go running through a cemetery here. But I think they are still places of death. And all of those headstones and all of that artwork and all of those statues of weeping maidens, they're all reminders of death. Where when you walk into a green cemetery, you don't see overt reminders of your mortality. It's not about your mortality. It's about life. And it's about your continued life. It's about... I think it's about your immortality. Because I think that, you know, in the regular cemetery, why they're so depressing, I think, in the end, is that they present life in a linear fashion. You're born, you live, you die, and you're buried, and here's where you're buried. And, you know, and you're literally moldering in the ground. And, in fact, I've called cemeteries landfills, because that's really how they function. And bodies are not returning to the earth. They are really moldering in their grave. A national cemetery, I think, in the end, is so much more positive. There's so much more enlivening because when you visit them, all you see is life. You see trees. You see flowers. You see those bees. You see those meadowlarks. You see the wind blowing through the meadow. It is all about life. And, you know, when you return to the ground there, you are perpetuating that life. Literally, with what's left of your body, your remains, you are preserving and perpetuating that life cycle. And I think that it is a cycle. And it makes you think about life differently. When I go up there, I mean, well, I'm not anxious to pass away, but I know deep down that a part of me is never going to pass away, that what's left of my body will go into the ground and will then decay and then re-nurse soil, push up those flowers and those native grasses, which will then die, which will then decompose, which will then re-nurse the soil, which will then grow another plant, and this whole cycle starts. And I think it's absolutely the way I want to see my life, which is, and I think the Green Cemetery shows life as, you know, you're born, you live your life, you die, and you continue to live on by the decomposition of your remains, perpetuating the natural, you know, cycle, creating oxygen through these plants, which then makes life possible for the people you leave behind. And by the way, your burial is also preserving this land from being developed. So I'm, you know, the money that I would spend, people spend to be buried in the natural cemeteries, goes to the preservation of this land so people can go back and reconnect to nature and sit on those benches and look out over South Mountain and these, you know, this beautiful wildflower with a forest behind them. So you are... you are perpetuating life. And we don't know what happens to our souls. We all have our beliefs, we have our theories, we have our religions. But I think it's a very small way on an actual level, on a really true level. You gain some small measure of immortality by being buried in a natural cemetery.
Yeah, it's really interesting. As you mentioned before, you kind of called it linear, and then there's like this idea of cyclic death and rebirth, which seems so much more holistic and sits so much nicer in the chest than this idea of a finality that's just so cold and extreme. And I'm curious, by contrast, if we were, and this is, I don't know if you're able to answer this question, but if we were to dig up a, let's say we were able to dig up a grave site that was done in the conventional embalming, let's say over the last 50 years, what would we even find? I mean, how long are these bodies preserved, and does dirt and soil and you know, do organisms make their way into that vault, or is it literally like a sealed-off crypt?
More like a sealed-off crypt, but I will say that there is no protection against the elements forever. One of my favorite advertising tags to one of the burial vaults is your last line of defense against Mother Nature.
You know, oh my God, that's it. You just summed it up with that, right? That's the mentality.
Yeah, so that's it, man. We don't want your body to decompose. Your body will decompose. I talked to a forensic anthropologist who goes, and he's sometimes called in to unearth dead bodies. So he'll go into a cemetery, and he says the vast majority of the burial vaults that I open up are filled with water. And so this last line of defense against Mother Nature, well, it turns out that even burial vaults crack.
Good.
That even your hermetically sealed metal casket, copper, what have you, that'll eventually be breached. The body, with all those embalming chemicals, will eventually decompose. And over long, long periods of time, you will eventually, return, have some contact with the elements, but it'll be a long, long time. And, you know, I think my point about green burial is, listen, I think you've got it. I think what I like about green burial is it says, we're going to accept this basic premise of biology, that the natural end of all life is decomposition and decay, and that you can fight it with concrete burial vaults, bulletproof caskets, you know, chemical embalming, but all of that will only delay, not halt, the inevitable. So why not just embrace the fact of our demise? And instead of wasting all of that money, instead of adding all those pollutants into the atmosphere and the creation of these products, instead of leaching all of these toxics into the environment, why don't we just let Mother Nature run her natural course? And, go back to the earth naturally.
And this way of thinking is obviously reemerged in many different ways. We see it in organic gardening and organic farming, and we see it in movement and exercise. We see people expressing it in all these different places now, this understanding that what's natural for us is not only better usually for our health, but is way less work and yields better results all the time. Do you feel that this movement towards green burial, are you really at the crest of a wave that's getting ready to kind of crash over us, or is this still decades out before people start to look at this in a more serious way? I mean, as I've been looking around, it seems like an idea that's really easy to embrace, but you're out there on the front line of it. What's it like out there?
Well, I've been doing this for about 10 years, and so I have to tell you, when I first was talking about this idea, people thought it was pretty strange. I mean, you know, they thought it was kind of neat, but they just couldn't imagine it taking hold. And I have argued this whole time, and I'm starting to see it come to a little bit of fruition, is that, this is just part of a larger greening that's washing over our society. So, you're suggesting, other ways that this is happening. So you've got organics, which is the largest segment of the food industry. So we've got organic food now. We've got, we're increasingly driving green cars, so our hybrids and, our Priuses. You've got homes being increasingly built green with their LEED certification and what have you. I mean, I don't think the funeral industry is going to somehow miss this larger regreening that's going through our society. Now, I will say that when I speak to younger audiences, when I speak to a lot of college students college-age kids, and, they just get it. They're like my daughters. They grew up with recycling in the classroom. They believe global warming is happening. You know, they're growing up with a much stronger environmental mindset that my generation, I'm at the tail end of the baby boomers, and certainly the older generation has. So they get it, and they're going to do it. I think that, but really, I think that, so the demographics are pushing this. So you've got the baby boom generation, the leading edge of the baby boom generation is slouching into retirement, beginning to consider the great hereafter. And my generation, you know, it's been, you know, we wrote our own wedding vows, we ushered in the first Earth Day, we're largely responsible for organics in the grocery store and what have you. I think as we approach end of life, and I think we're going to go green. And I make presentations to funeral directors, and I have a separate presentation for them where I make the economic case for green burial, and a lot of it's just based on demographics. You know, yeah, you can continue to embalm and do this, but, you know, the day is coming, and the day is coming very quickly, where this is not going to be the default anymore. So anecdotally, I can tell you that we've got 150 national cemeteries now. There are, 400 funeral directors around the country that have signed on to agree to offer green burial goods and services. So they will, you know, offer to help do a home funeral, or they have a refrigeration unit in their funeral home instead of, you know, embalming. They have a large array of biodegradable caskets in the casket display room, so you've got that. There is about another 400 women I know of in an organization who are traveling the country and giving workshops on how to wash and dress and lay out bodies just as our forebears used to do. All legally, here's how you do it, and you can do it. So, and then we've got this larger conversation that's happening around death. We've got, you know, I went to a death cafe recently where a couple of people got together at a bookstore, and, you know, we were all talking about, you know, how we want to be buried, and this person died, and how we handle the funerals. There are these death cafes that are happening all around the country.
Wow.
So I think that, you know, death has been, as you said, the great taboo topic in this country for a very, very long time, and I think that is all starting to change now. And I think that green burial is just part of that larger conversation. And I tell you what, I think that, you know, as much as I do anything, I'm talking about green burial, but I think what I want the book to do is to help people talk about the issue. And see that it's really not as scary as we think it is, and that there are these really lovely and beautiful and affirming ways of considering our demise that make the conversation possible. So I think that we are well on the way for, as I've always thought, for green burial to go mainstream.
That's so cool, and there's some interesting ironies in there. I mean, I see how it's a lot easier to talk about your car or to talk about your, you know, your shopping list than it is to talk about dying, and understandably, and I get why it is likely the fundamental taboo of, you know, human nature. But there's also something ironic about, like, an older generation needing to die off for new ideas to come. Given the topic, I find that's kind of funny. I'm curious for you how it's been individually, personally, on this journey, because you've taken up a mission that is just, again, on such a strong taboo. I mean, how has it been for you? Have people embraced this idea? Have you felt a lot of resistance from people over the years? Do you feel that this work has associated you strongly with death, or do you feel it's associated you strongly with life in the environment? And how has that been for you on a personal journey?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I've met so many different kinds of people. There are people around this country who are really drawn to talking about death and dying, who are, you know, they're either really into cemeteries, or they're into sort of creepy embalming stuff, or they watch all these, you know, forensic science shows, and so they like the topic. I'm not one of those people. I mean, I'm an environmental journalist. I came upon this idea because I used to write a weekly column for the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, and you know, I had to fill up 750 words every week. So I heard about this cemetery in South Carolina where the dead were buried in the woods, you know, wrapped in winding bedcloths, and the whole idea was to allow them to go back to nature. I thought it was a great idea for a couple of columns. I went down, and I was blown away, frankly, by what I saw there. And then what I saw at this cemetery, Ramsey Creek Preserve in South Carolina, what I saw happening there as I began doing more research, I saw it was tied up into, you know, all kinds of other things that were happening on a natural level in death care. So you've got, you've got cremation, which many people choose because it's a greener option. I found people who were doing backyard burials and coffin makers making coffins out of all kinds of interesting biodegradable materials. So I think it represented this movement. So then it became this book topic. So, you know, I came at it as a journalist, And then I just became, personally invested in it, I think particularly with the establishment of the cemetery. It's hard to write about death and dying when I've interviewed all these family members, and these were very emotional interviews, and it's very personal when you talk about the love, you talk about the passing, the decline and passing and burial and funeral of your loved one. And so it became intensely personal in the course of the research of the book. So I've been in a strange situation for a journalist where, you know, I'm supposed to bring a lot of objectivity to bear when I do my reporting, but it's been very hard to be impartial about this. And I will tell you straight up that I'm an advocate for this. And now here I am, part of the movement by establishing a cemetery. At first, people's reaction was, they didn't really want to talk about it. They thought it was a little odd. But then once we got talking, what I've found almost to a person, Daniel, is that people kind of, I don't know, maybe it's because it is so affirming. They are more happy to talk about it, because I can't tell you how many people have said, oh, thank God. All I've told my family all these years is to put me in a burlap sack and bury me on the back. I'm glad that you can do something like that.
Right.
And people come at it from so many different angles. Some people like it because it saves money. Some people like it because it's green. Some people like the whole idea of doing something that harkens back to a long tradition that they remember from their great-grandparents or grandparents or what have you. So it has become more of a personal mission.
Yeah, I feel like as you say that, it's like they got me on the way in, you know. I didn't get to have the home birth. I didn't get to be in that comforting. I didn't get that on the way in. I want it on the way out. You know, it's important to me. So I really appreciate the work you're doing, man. You got an ally in me and you got an ally in this community, and anything we can do to support your vision and your work, please let us know. How do you want to send people to find your book? And is there anywhere else you'd like to point people to get more involved with this?
Sure, yeah. So the book, Grave Matters, I'd love to say it's available everywhere, but it's, you can order it at bookstores, you can go online and find it. I also maintain a website which has a lot of the information that we covered here in brief, so that's gravematters.us, as in the United States. I've been blogging for years, so I've been blogging less as I've been working on this other book project, but I'm firing up the blog again. I do Twitter and Facebook, and you can find all of that. So I do continue to follow the Green Burial Movement, I travel around, and I am helping other people establish things. And so if you're interested in following that movement or learning more about Green Burial, go to Grave Matters, and you can find links to all of these sites.
Hey, Mark, thank you so much for your time with us, and it's really appreciated. And it's interesting to say, but I feel like this conversation that we just had is going to impact a lot of people's, the conclusion to a lot of people's earthly life here, which is, I've never said that at the end of an interview. So, hey, thank you so much, and just know you're really appreciated by me and by everyone who's been listening.
Yeah, well, thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation, Daniel.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the show. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you would, leave a rating and a review. That's really going to help us get this message out to more people. And it's going to help us know what you really like and what you don't like, and help us really tailor this show to your needs and to what you want to hear. Please stay connected with me at danielvitalis.com and sign up for my newsletter and my magazine, Rewild Yourself. And you can subscribe to both of those right there on danielvitalis.com. Got lots of really great shows lined up, and I'm going to keep bringing you more great information. And until then, keep rewilding yourself. Show you.